Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
The Improbable War explains why conflict between the USA and China cannot be ruled out. In 1914, a war between the great powers was considered unlikely, yet it happened. We learn only from history, and popular though the First World War analogy is, the lessons we draw from its outbreak are usually mistaken. That's the premise of the book, The Improbable War, China, the United States, and the Logic of Great Power Conflict. It's by Christopher Coker. Delighted to be joining me on the line from the UK, the author, Christopher Coker himself. Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. We seem to spend most of our time worrying about what the states are going to be doing next at the moment in this period of uncertainty. We have the escalating conflict in, or the escalating war of wards, at least, between the US and North Korea. Are we overlooking China, and should we be worried about the state that China is in bringing itself almost to the point of war?
Well, I think we should be a little bit more concerned in the mid-term, certainly, about China, because most of the conflicts between great powers in the last 300 years have been about the international rules of the system. And in the Party Congress last month, Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, made quite clear that China's moment in history had arrived. He's offering an alternative model to the American one, a Leninist-Confucian model, if you want to call it that. He has quite a lot of support from countries that are pushing back against the West, that feel that the West is on the defensive now, is weak, hold in the water. And this is precisely the moment where great power conflicts tend to break out.
And we're looking at the rapid militarization, if you like, of China. They are pouring, as you explain, huge amounts of resources and manpower into their military machine.
Yes, there's been a 230% increase in the defense budget in the last 10 years. And what's particularly worrying is that they're concentrating a lot on naval power, building another aircraft carrier. They are, of course, in the South China Seas, extending their bases. And again, to relate to what I said a moment ago, Robert Gates, the former defense secretary in the Obama administration, gave testimony to the Senate Armed Services Committee before he stood down, saying it's becoming increasingly difficult for the United States to maintain freedom of navigation in the South China Seas, which is its principal role and always has been, freedom of the seas.
Indeed, and you know that you can look at naval superiority as harking back to 1914. A lot of people are drawing roles and drawing parallels between what happened then between the great powers and the outbreak of the First World War. People being sucked into a conflict they didn't really want to be, and also this naval dominance. Do you think it's a fair analogy to make?
There are some parallels. They're not exactly precise. There was a naval arms race between Britain and Germany, which actually came to an end in 1912. But then, interestingly, that was the year in which the German Navy began planning quite seriously, having lost the arms race, for a naval conflict in the North Sea. It's one of the points I try to make in my book, that we mustn't expect excessive rationality on the part of great powers. And the other major problem, it seems to me, if you're looking back at 1914, was, as the title of my book suggests, everyone was going around saying that another war in Europe was so improbable that it wasn't going to happen, largely because same arguments that are rehearsed today, economic interdependence, globalization, though the term globalization wasn't actually used, that the banks would collapse within 6 months, that the bond markets would collapse in 3 months. These were the articles that were being put forward by publications such as The Economist in 1913 and early 1914. So that's why I think that the 1914 analogy is the most important one that we have.
And do you also think that perhaps that people, when it comes to China, they have blinkers when it comes to China's great and colourful, powerful history? We seem to think of, as Westerners, of China as only being from Mao Zedong and the Cultural Revolution. However, inside China, they're talking about, I think it's called the century of humiliation, and they're now calling on their illustrious past.
Yes, that's another parallel, actually. The Germans were certainly going places. In 1914, Germany had already overtaken the United Kingdom in terms of economic strength. Germany didn't really need a war in 1914, but it suffered from an emotional problem, and that emotional problem was resentment. It was denied, as the Germans used to call it, their place in the sun. The problem we have with China is that it remembers the century of humiliation in the 19th century, the two Opium Wars, when the British were sailing up and down the Yangtze River unchallenged. They are resentful of the fact that the United States seems unwilling to accept that their moment has come. And this emotional register is extremely important for great powers. They do have emotional regimes like human beings. Resentment is, a major factor here.
Also, the people seem to be highlighting as well the possibility of rogue generals. I mean, China has a huge military capability. China is a huge country. And there is the thought of a rogue general setting off a missile or firing on a vessel. That has to be factored in as well.
Well, the first few months of the George Bush administration, that was a few months before 9/11 and the war on terror, which occupied us all, saw a near miss between two planes, an American reconnaissance plane and a Chinese plane. The actual incident was occasioned by the Chinese Air Force on its own, without any direction from Beijing, from the government. So, again, one of the problems with conflicts and wars is that they're often accidental. No one sits around the table actually planning a timetable and suggesting that we're going to go to war on August the 1st, 1914. But you have incidents, and the number of incidents in the South China Seas between American and Chinese ships is rather disturbing at the moment.
And also, there's a parallel of perhaps that both sides, if you like, you know, America is under the Trump administration, seems to have picked on North Korea as its cause célèbre, as it's something it's decided that something needs to be done about North Korea, and has been making some rumbling noises about China, even though it's been making overtures in trade. And China itself has perhaps an inability to take on a world view, having been isolated. I mean, we all remember the overtures that were made with the historic Nixon trip to China, but it sees itself as spent so long as a one-party state that it's unable to adapt to a modern world view.
Yes, yes and no. Certainly China at the moment is a regional power, not a global power. It has the strength of that position because it has two objectives. They've been there since day one. One is to get the United States out of East Asia, out of South Korea, out of Taiwan, and the other is to send the American fleet back to Hawaii and out of the Western Pacific, back to Hawaii, where it was. You may remember, of course, in 1941 when the Japanese launched the Pearl Harbor attack. The United States is a global power. It has to think about Iran in the Middle East. It's got many other problems, Russia in particular, in NATO. So, again, rather like Britain in 1914, the United States is massively overstretched, and the Chinese can concentrate and focus on their one strategic aim. But I wouldn't say that they were entirely regional. The Belt Road, this new communications system which is being built across Central Asia, which now has 64 different countries signed up to it, is a way by which China's hoping to avoid being contained at sea by the American Navy and giving it the freedom of maneuver to actually become a major Middle East player. So they are playing with the long game in mind as well.
And also, there has obviously been a lot of Chinese influence and investment in Africa as well. We've seen them getting involved in infrastructure projects as well. So perhaps China is wanting to put a marker down on the world. Could this be, could something like Taiwan and take, you know, taking back control over Taiwan perhaps be seen as boosting their international standing and being taken seriously as a global power?
Well, I think they certainly want Taiwan back by 2049 at the very latest. That will be the 100th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. You're quite right about Africa. They're now the largest lender in the world. They have so much cash so that they can actually outcompete organizations like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which the United States is still, of course, the principal member of. They need the resources of Africa. They need that second aircraft carrier in the Indian Ocean to give them access to those resources, since 90% of everything still comes by sea. So there are geopolitical strategic games already beginning further west from the South China Seas. So the Indian Ocean itself is, I think, an area of contestation, which is why the Indian government, which has woken up rather late to this, is now increasingly interested in doing some kind of exercises with the U.S. Navy and perhaps some European navies as well.
And we talk about this as you know, the possibility of conflict. Of course, we're forgetting that an awful lot of conflict can take place virtually, if you like, with the cyberspace we have attacks we've seen. We've seen, you know, governments having their organizations taken down in cyber attacks. And you draw the point that perhaps there could be wars played out in cyberspace, and the ruinous effects that would have, not in terms of life, but in terms of damage to financial institutions, world trade and the markets. And this is a possibility we haven't really factored in.
Oh, absolutely. We used to think that two thermonuclear powers could not go to war against each other, but there are other domains within which you can find yourself in conflict with another great power, and cyberspace is one of them. The Chinese are probably the number one country in the world in cyber warfare. They attack on a regular basis the United States and other countries. Also, in addition to cyber warfare, of course, is information warfare that is undermining the morale of, in this case, the United States, in the way that the Russians have been doing for the last couple of years, which is now, of course, a matter under investigation. So there are many different spheres in which you can have a conflict between two great powers. The problem with cyber warfare is a problem that was enunciated by the defense secretary in this country a couple of months ago, when he said that if we do find ourselves under threat in the cyberspace domain, we do exercise the right to use physical force to take out the people who are actually attacking us. So in other words, the conflict won't be confined to cyberspace. If it becomes as serious as you suggested, which indeed might be the case, the United States would have to react in the usual physical way of taking out some of the areas involved in the cyber conflict.
What would you hope then would be the reaction and the response to both the Americans and the Chinese to the points that you raise in your book, The Improbable War? Do we think we need more statesmanship? Do we think we need to be they need to sit down and have dialogue and reach détente? What or do you think that this is, we're looking at two clashing ideologies who there's very little common ground that we can meet?
Well, you have two countries with two different worldviews, two different political cultures, two different sets of historical experiences, and two different kinds of rationalities. The Americans go in for the direct approach, try to do the art of the deal, as Trump likes to call it. The Chinese are much more relational. They have networks. They like to work through those. They try to avoid confrontation if they possibly can. But both countries are, I think, on a collision course. China, because it wants the United States out of East Asia and the Western Pacific, and it's not going to bide its time indefinitely. The United States, because it's not yet ready to accept that its hegemonic position in the world is probably at an end. The British, don't forget, had one great consolation when they were challenged by the United States at the end of the 19th century. They talked about English-speaking peoples, country cousins, Anglospheres, alliances between Anglo-Saxon countries. So they had a whole range of nice metaphors which enabled them to see this as a kind of relay race. They were part of the team, even though they passed the baton on to the last country, the US. The US can't tell itself these stories. China's not a country that it can feel happy surrendering number one position to. And that, I think, is going to lead to resentment on the part of the United States in the future. So we go back to the same kind of emotional register, which will emotionally charge the conflict at some point.
And of course, this is an area with thousands of years of history, and also other prior countries that are involved in there. We think of the Koreas, we think of Japan, which is obviously very, very alarmed by the current events going on at the moment, and all those Pacific Rim tigers that was going to be the darling economies, what, some 10, 15 years ago. So it really is an area in which both sides perhaps want to have influence. Have some historical. I mean, the Americans have had some influence, obviously, in Philippines and Japan. Both sides should perhaps tread very carefully indeed, lest smaller nations drag them into a bigger conflict.
Yes. One of the ways in which the United States finds itself on the defensive is that the Chinese are making bids to detach its allies from it. The success story has been the Philippines. That was the country that took the South China Sea's issue to the court in The Hague. The court ruled in favor of the Philippines. The Philippines then dropped the case and took the Chinese position and Chinese money that came with it. So one of the ancient continuities in Chinese history has been a tribute system. It hasn't been a colonial power in the European sense of the word. It's not been interested in actually taking territory, but it's insisted that its neighbors pay tribute to it and accept that it's the number one supreme civilization in the area. I think that they will try to detach these countries one by one, South Korea being another one at some time in the future. Singapore, there's already a debate, national debate in Singapore, about how long the Americans can be trusted to be there and whether one has to make accommodations with China. Japan is the key country because it's the big American aircraft carrier in the area, and that is where the conflict with North Korea and the United States comes in. It's extremely important how that is resolved, because if America blinks, then I think even the Japanese will begin to ask whether the United States is a very worthwhile ally or whether they have to come to some kind of accommodation with their big neighbor.
This is interesting. Interesting. What is the proverb? May you live in interesting times, I believe is the one that everybody trots out at this time of the year.
Indeed.
Indeed. The book is called The Improbable War, China, the United States, and the Logic of Great Power. It's available now by Hearst and Co. It's by Christopher Coker. Christopher, if people wish to find out more information about this book and stay informed, I mean, where do you think? I mean, where do we think we go from here in terms of the relations between the two powers?
I think a lot will be determined by what happens with North Korea next year. I think in the Chinese military are not entirely unhappy with how the situation is squaring up, precisely because the United States is huffing and puffing and doing very little, and precisely because North Korea may eventually call its bluff. We'll have to see. This is an administration in Washington that is inconsistent, incoherent, doesn't really have a long-term strategy, has a Secretary of State who doesn't really know very much about diplomacy. We'll have to see. It does look increasingly as though the rest of the world sees China as the grown-up in the room and is already beginning to come to terms with a transfer of power. But as I said, the United States is not yet ready to acknowledge that transfer is either necessary or inevitable. So we just have to keep watching this channel.
The book is called The Improbable War, China, the United States, and the Logics of Great Power. But Christopher, if people want to find out more information about the book or yourself, is there a website they can go to? Is there social media that you, or do you tweet, for example? How can they follow or get in touch with you?
I certainly don't tweet, and the example of Donald Trump makes me not want to tweet. But it's online, and you can see it from the website.
Christopher Coker, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.